And with us on the line from, it's actually not a line out there. It's via satellite, via telecommunications of the late 20th and 21st century, is Dr. David Sussman. Are you there, David?
I sure am.
That's wonderful. Glad to hear it. Thank you so very much for joining us today. Dr. Sussman is also Professor Sussman, probably also called David. I'm not sure which way you want to go with that.
David's great.
All right. Very good. He's the author of a brand new book called Selling Sounds, The Commercial Revolution in American Music. He's a professor of history at the University of Delaware. And is the recipient also of the Bancroft Prize, by the way. I wanted to say congratulations. I know it's a while ago at the University of what's that place in the city? Oh, yes, called Columbia. The Bancroft Prize, there are several of them. This is for the best dissertation at Columbia. Congratulations.
Well, thank you.
It's a very nice thing. One of my colleagues is a recipient of that, a guy named Cyrus Vieser, who won that award when he was there. So he was saying, oh, that's a big deal. That's really, really a big deal. So congratulations. And the book is a real pleasure to read. And I just wanted to say thanks very much for putting this out there. Fascinating. Selling Sounds.
Let's introduce our audience first of all to just the basic concept. What do you mean by selling sound?
There are a couple of basic ways of thinking about the book. One of them is it's a history of the rise of music as big business, and another way is to think it's a history of the commercialization of music, or the commodification of sound. I think those are sort of three overlapping ways that I conceptualize the book, and I think all three are kind of interwoven in the ways that I develop the history.
Mm-hmm. Because post-Civil War America, there was music. There was music before then, but it wasn't sold as a product. Is that correct?
The way that the industry, there were instances in which people paid for music. I mean, minstrel shows, people, you know, were a commercial enterprise.
Mm-hmm. People have been paying for music since you have people wandering around playing music in minstrelsy in a traditional version of
well, playing
Europe
the playing the paying the performers, but not necessarily for the individual songs.
Right. And I mean, you had, you know, there's a music publishing industry that's
right.
Vaguely recognizable that goes back to the 18th century, 17th century. Mm-hmm. But what happens in the late 19th and early 20th century is you see this incredible expansion of the music industry, and you see it developing in a number of different registers at the same time. And you see this commercial sophistication and this marketing sort of marketing apparatus that develops around music all mm-hmm. at the same time, and they sort of coalesce in this way that really transforms what it means to have music available in some form that you pay for.
I think one of the most interesting things in that is this amazingly fascinating interaction between the technological shifts in the musical production industry and the way that structures the song itself, that the nature of the disc, the nature of the gramophone, actually transforms what we think of as a song and creates a modern song.
And
I was wondering if you could speak to that a little.
Well, there are a couple of things that are going on. One of them is the technological incentive to conform to the technology. You have a certain length of 2.5-3 minutes that you could put on a phonographic cylinder or a phonographic disc, and so the song forms are limited by that. But there's also a way that the songwriting is changed at the same time in the music publishing and songwriting business known as Tin Pan Alley.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that they are trying to sell people on songs, whether it's through records, which is actually sort of a little bit later for Tin Pan Alley, or initially through sheet music. And the song form is changing in Tin Pan Alley with a greater amount of pressure or greater focus on things like the chorus or a catchy title in ways that were unprecedented.
The hook.
The hook. The idea of the hook as being something that would hook into people and make them want to keep singing something. And when the only way to keep singing it was to get a hold of that sheet music, that was a commercial incentive, really.
Shall we hear an example of this?
Sure. Do you have something queued up, or you want me to suggest something?
Oh, my honey, better hurry and let me end. Ain't you going, to the leader man, ragged meter man? Oh, my honey, let me take you to Alexander's grandstand, the brass band. Ain't you coming along? Come on here, Alexander's ragtime band. Come on here.
And it's that repetition, come on, come on, that is, as you point out in the book, is quite revolutionary.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they really just keep hammering home what it is that will get into people. And there's a lot of competition for consumers' ears.
What was preceding that? I mean, if this kind of repetition is new, is that people didn't repeat choruses, they didn't repeat verses? What was going on?
Well, going back to the song forms in sort of the vernacular song forms in the 19th century, what you see is the emergence of a chorus. And what preceded that were various stages. Initially, songs didn't necessarily have choruses, or some songs didn't. They might be long, multi-verse, multi-stanza works that might have had a chorus or didn't. It didn't matter that much. Mm-hmm. Those that did, the chorus didn't occupy a particularly central part of the song.
High mountain ballads with 15 verses.
Right. And in the ballad form, there's something going on. There's a narrative, and you want to know what happens to the, you know, to the murderer and so forth. And What happens with Tin Pan Alley is you see this sort of shift.
Uh-huh.
And although there might be a narrative in some of these songs, it falls away. And one of the best examples of that I came across in doing the book was in the song After the Ball by Charles K. Harris, which was in some ways the first really big pop song that that we would recognize. And it's still a widely known song for many, many listeners, perhaps. And the chorus is very well known, and there is actually a narrative going on in the verses. But by the time that song makes it to record, the song is written in 1892, 93, by the time it's recorded on record later, not even all the verses are recorded.
So they actually abridge the song to fit into the technological shift that's occurred, and in a sense reduce it, make it leaner and tighter.
That's right. That's right. And whatever happened, I mean, and the last verse of that particular song is that there's a catch to the whole story.
Right.
It sort of reveals the whole thing. But
tragic twist.
A tragic twist, indeed.
Let's hear a little bit of After the Ball.
Okay.
Speaking. Hello, friend. You know, it seems only yesterday that I wrote that old-time song of mine, both words and music, of After the Ball. You know, I have a great fondness for that old song, which I composed way back in 1892.
So when was this actually released?
Would you like to hear it? Well, I'm going to try and sing it for you.
Let's hear a little bit.
Of course, I haven't got a voice like Caruso, but the sentiment is still there. And I hope that you will enjoy it the same as your mothers did years ago.
Maiden, climb an old man's knee. Beg for a story. Do uncomfortably. Why are you single? Why live alone?
Now, the way he spoke about that song before singing it, the talk up, which is, you know, completely common in today's media, we do it in radio all the time, that was revolutionary, wasn't it? He was promoting the song.
This is one of the things that really distinguished Charles K. Harris, is that he really had a sense of how to do that, how to build the popularity of a song, opposed to simply composing a song and then waiting for people to enjoy it, to sing it, to like it.
Mm-hmm. And one of the great aspects of your story, David, is the way you show how advertising grows up alongside the commercialization of music.
Very much, very much. It's really quite fascinating. It was one of the things that I really didn't quite expect to find so much, but there are a couple of ways that that's happening. One of them is through the songwriting, in which the songwriters and the song publishers are, in a sense, advertisers themselves. They're advertising for their song, mm-hmm. by virtue of the song form and their promotional mechanisms. And then simultaneously or in parallel with this, the record industry, particularly the Victor Talking Machine Company, later RCA Victor, it becomes a leader in consumer advertising, one of mm-hmm. the leading advertisers of any kind in the United States.
But the other piece that comes with this that I thought was so fascinating was the whole structure of how promotion occurs. That it's not just advertising, but that so many of the forms that later figure in radio, TV, whatever, including payola, are invented within a decade or 15 years by Tin Pan Alley.
Oh, very much, very much. There's this vigorous competition to get the songs out, and they are hard-pressed to figure out how to, the different publishers are hard-pressed to figure out how to get that limited airspace, basically, for consumers' ears. And so they pay performers to perform their songs. They pay performers to keep the songs in their repertoire when another publisher would come along and try to knock a song out of the somebody's act. And then these vaudeville performers took the songs across the country. And in the years before radio was not really popularized in the United States, broadcast radio, until the mid-20s. But before that, you already have this really complex network of song promotion through the vaudeville stages. Nothing electronic about it. No electrical technologies involved. It's quite interesting.
Mm-hmm. One of the features in the talk-up to that song was, he says, "I don't have a voice like Caruso." And he could say that knowing that everybody in America, probably most of Western Europe, possibly parts of Africa and Asia as well, would know who he's talking about. Now, there had been other celebrities, other stars, like, say, Jenny Lind, the Swedish Nightingale, pardon me, who had been brought over by, I believe, Barnum, and really promoted as this magnificent voice and was turned into a real celebrity. Sarah Bernhardt was something of a celebrity, where her loves, her personality was a factor. But Caruso's really unique. He's a new kind of creature. Could you talk about that a little?
Yes. Caruso, he really is. He's a new kind of creature because his popularity, and you describe it quite well, he was sort of the standard, the gold standard of vocalists, and that would have been widely known. And his popularity grew in conjunction with, and was interdependent with, the rise of the phonograph industry. There have been other great singers, well-known singers before him, but none had a popularity that grew through this sort of marketing mechanism of the industry.
And when this happens, does it also change the medium that he's in? Because opera at that point has a very large mass base. And it has in Italy, it's very much of the working class as well as the upper class. It's not something that's the way it is now, where it's perceived as this elite, high cultural medium that, you know, oh my God, you're listening to opera, which I've only begun doing, by the way, in the last few years. And it's a little embarrassing to say that I approach it in my 50s because it was such an alien thing to me and was viewed as something that was so different than what I am. But the quality of the voices is just amazing. But this idea that opera would be something that everybody would want to listen to.
Well, What Caruso did is he was the main star of the Victor Company's Red Seal special series of records. And these were supposed to be the high-class records that were an incentive for people to buy phonographs in the first place. And I think a lot of people did listen to Caruso records, but they also functioned as a way of justifying the purchase of a phonograph. And then once you had a phonograph, you could buy all kinds of pop records or anything else you might listen to.
Now,
if I could just finish that one thought, and as far as the mass base goes, he was also sort of the quintessential middle brow artist. This is sort of the emergence of a middle brow literature in the 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, you see Caruso, who represents this kind of high class culture, but in this adapted form for mass audiences.
We're speaking with Professor David Sussman, and that is spelled S-U-I-S-S-U-I-S-M-A-N. And the reason I spell that out for you folks is because the music that we're playing for you this morning while we're speaking to Professor Sussman is found on his website, davidsussman.net.
It's the first book I've ever reviewed that actually has a musical website associated with it. And I want to thank you for that. I think it's great. I even mentioned that in the review.
Oh, perfect.
And I think it's a lovely feature that lets people really connect to this element. What we're listening now, of course, in the bed is Enrico Caruso.
And let's listen to a little bit of this.
Tu sei pagliaccio, vesti la tua la faccia marina, la gente fa
I can't hear that without thinking of Bugs Bunny and Alfalfa, but that's me.
The music is wonderful. It doesn't quite translate over the computer because of the digital the problems with compressing audio on a computer. But he has a gorgeous voice. David, I want to talk a little bit about time. And I've always had, my wife makes fun of me because I've always had difficulty understanding time as it's expressed, especially in science fiction where people go back and forth in time. But prior to the invention, Edison's invention and Berliner's adaptation of the gramophone and the phonograph and technology that allowed people to record sound, you would hear music in the home or you'd go to a concert, and time wasn't in a box. It just It just flowed. You listened to music, and you remembered in your mind. You remembered the pleasure you got out of the music, or maybe you didn't like the music. But now, by having this recording technology, you could capture time. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, there is this, phenomenological transformation that's going on in this time period through the phonograph and a number of other technologies that really change, in a sense, what time means to people or how people understand the relationship between being and time. So that you could store these little bits of time. I think of it like damming a river. It could get stored up, and then you could let it flow again when you chose. And the phonograph is one of a few different technologies that really had this destabilizing effect on people's ordinary assumptions. The photographic camera was another one. In some ways, the telegraph, which shortened the distances between places, and transportation technologies like the railroad did as well. But the phonograph had this unique aspect of being connected to the voice. And there are a lot of ways in which people's understanding of the voice as the expression, the sort of essential expression of a being, that was part of the wonder of capturing time in the grooves of these records.
Mm-hmm. We take this for granted now. I'm holding in my hand a compact disc. We've had vinyl LPs. We have digital files where for 99 cents you can purchase pretty much any song made available to certain large corporations to start with the letter A, which will not be named on this program, but where do you stand in terms of whether or not capturing sound and commercializing sound in this way has been good or bad for culture and society? Or is it an unfair juxtaposition between good and bad? What do you think?
I think there are a lot of things that are great about it. Let me just say that. But I think what happens that is, in a sense, more negative, or something I would raise more questions about, is when that becomes the prevailing way that people hear and relate mm-hmm. to music. There are great things that happen when people have access to sounds produced elsewhere in time and space, and I'm, the first of recipients of that. I mean, I wouldn't have been able to grow up listening to music and thinking about music
right.
if that were not the case. But music is also a kind of social engagement and a kind of social interaction. And there are a lot of things that music does and can do and ways that it functions that exist beyond sound recordings. And one of the concerns that I have about this model of music making and music listening that's limited by recordings is that those get pushed aside.
Mm-hmm. One of the features in that I want to ask you about just one comment the question of time it's the real linking of it's like linking radio and Berliner and Caruso with Frederick Winslow Taylor. This is an entire transitional moment in life where time becomes compressed and captured and recorded and metered in an entirely new way. And so it's occurring throughout the society, and this is one of those amazing ways in which it's happening. Is in our world very often the player is a free good. For all intents and purposes, you can get a CD player. They give them away as premiums in certain kinds of situations, and you're really paying for the music.
And you can download the software
right.
today to play.
Right, and
mm-hmm.
you're paying for the music. But what you're talking about is a different time. Is there a point where is that change where the player, the hardware, is a free good? Does it ever occur in the period you're talking about? Or in this case, as you say, they're selling records to sell phonographs. And where's the balance in that for the profitability? Because the same company is making both the phonograph and the disc.
Yeah, that really happens later. Because in the period that I'm looking at, which really establishes the foundations of a lot of the ways that we understand music today. As you said, the companies that are producing the phonographs are producing the records, and it's the and so the profitability for them is in both, but more so in the phonographs. And the way that the whole industry grows is by recognizing that the records are an incentive to buy the things that they will actually make money from. Mm-hmm. So they promote records in order to get people to buy the phonographs.
They're also promoting the collecting of records, and the records take much less to produce. So is there a point at which they realize, wow, once we've got them hooked both with the song, with its hooks, and the medium of the phonograph, now it's like a cash cow.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I'd say the second decade of the country, they really start to understand that it's people's ongoing, continual record buying that's going to keep them invested in the industry. They train retailers, the major manufacturers train retailers to teach consumers to want to buy something new all the time, not to be content with what they have, but to understand that there are going to be new releases every month, and they're on a certain day, it's the 25th of the month, you know there are going to be a whole slew of new releases. And so it's a matter of training consumers to be lifelong buyers of records. And that starts actually by the 19-teens. As far as the shift, I think it's a gradual shift. And I think even by the 1920s, it's already well underway.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to, our guest is Professor David Sussman. He is a professor of history at the University of Delaware and author of the book Selling Sounds, The Commercial Revolution in American Music. It's on Harvard University Press. David, to continue this thought, do you see the ability of Tin Pan Alley and its promoters to manipulate consumers as the harbinger of everything else that follows in our consumer advertising media driven environment?
Everything, probably not, but quite a bit. I mean, one of the things that's so amazing about the rise of the music industry is recognizing how music can be infused into other kinds of commercial activities. Music can be used to sell other things. We sort of take this for granted in terms of jingles and so forth today, which we might expect to some extent from TV commercials or whatever. But the other thing that music is doing is more subtle in promoting consumerism. The record industry is one of the leading industries to promote consumer credit, people buying on credit, which was the exact opposite of how people had purchased goods in the 19th century. You would never go into debt. But here the record industry is teaching people that it's good to go into a certain amount of debt. It allows you to buy things that you wouldn't otherwise. Another way that the music industry is really a very innovative and influential marketer is through having music in different kinds of commercial environments. Restaurants and department stores are enlivened and function better commercially when there's music present. So I think these are a couple of the ways that the music industry really is cast a long shadow.
And yet, who owns the music in those settings is a very contested space.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, what happens is that the other sort of the underlying shift that goes on in the rise of the music industry is the growing importance of copyright.
Mm-hmm.
And the story has one of the chapters is about the sort of transformation of copyright in this period, because copyright becomes what the songwriters and the song publishers end up really making their money on, and it is in some cases very contested about who has the right to play a piece of music and for what for what purposes. But this ends up having a very, very extensive and long history that really commercializes many kinds of musical listening. Okay, just to give you one quick example, Happy Birthday to You, which is a song that everybody right. knows, is a song we might think that belongs to everybody, but in fact it doesn't. It belongs to the Warner Music Group.
Yeah.
And whenever it's played in a restaurant or on a TV show or whatever, there's a copyright.
There's an ongoing battle about whether or not artists actually should be a part of the get a share of the pie as well, as opposed to the copyright holder. And this was even, it's funny, even as I was writing the review, I was reading the paper on the morning that I started writing it, where there was another presentation in Congress about why artists should get a share of the pie. So this is really an ongoing war in our culture.
By artists, you mean performers.
Yeah, the performer.
And they are getting a piece of the pie, because the new paradigm, especially in terms of music over the internet, is that you don't pay the publishers like you do in radio. Radio pays the publishers. In over the internet, the paradigm is you pay the performers.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, you're paying the record companies, and they're supposed to then give money to the performers. So yes, it's your book is relevant, so relevant to the discussions that are ongoing today. Professor Sussman, can you stay with us another few minutes?
I'd be happy to.
Okay, great. We're going to take a short break now. Listen to some more Caruso, and should mention.
Don't we always on this show
listen to Caruso?
Yeah,
I don't know. Do we?
This is a first.
This is WMBR Cambridge Radio with a View.
Enrico Caruso on Radio with a View. That is a first. Well, second. We played him a few minutes ago. With us, of course, is Dr. David Sussman, who is at the University of Delaware and is the author of Selling Sounds, a book that really, if you're interested in sound, this is really special. You derive a lot of your sort of intellectual background from people like Walter Benjamin, and coming out of the idea of looking at the work of art in the age of mechanical reproduction, that is a very important piece. Had you thought to do this before you read Benjamin, before you were reading this? Which led you? Were you led to theory, or did theory lead you?
at the risk of being a little cutesy about it, it was a little dialectical.
Yeah, that's a good thing.
Yeah. In truth, I had a long-standing interest in the relationship between music and business. The relationship between music and capitalism was really maybe one of the things that I had been interested in trying to figure out when I went to graduate school. And thinking about that led me in a few different directions, and I did some research on the first major black-owned record company, mm-hmm. Black Swan Records, which I write about in the book. And in the course of doing that research, that sort of revealed to me that there was a whole record industry going on in existence in the 1920s that I hadn't understood up to that point. And this around this time, I was also reading sort of more and more critical theory, and Benjamin and Adorno's works were very helpful for me in challenging some things that I had otherwise thought, or recognizing that there are things that I could focus on in a critical, theoretical way that would be helpful.
You talked about Black Swan in the book, and I think it's a marvelous chapter. Americans today, many young people, although we know about